take a walk before it was totally.
Good morning, everyone. I'm convening the April 7th, 2015 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. Good morning to each of you. We have a full house. Thank you for your patience while we completed some last-minute paperwork here. We've got a full schedule, and we're going to move it here straight away. With that, I'm going to open a reconsideration and work session of House Bill 2653. Representative Gorsuch, your choice, sir, whether you would like to speak here or there.
Oh, I'll go down there.
Thank you.
Otherwise, I can't see Representative Esquivel well enough. It's very important.
If we could go through this first script just so it's back before the committee.
Okay. All right. If you'll just stand at ease for a moment. Sure. You're fine right there.
Okay.
And I move that the rules, Vice Chair Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2653.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2653. This motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, hearing none. Motion is adopted. Vice Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2653 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended recommendation.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2653 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? I'm seeing none, hearing none. If there's no objection, the motion then will be before this committee. Thank you, committee members. Representative, there may be some explanation that's needed as to why this is before us again. And I think for all good reasons, and I know that I appreciated your explanation, and I'm sure the rest of the committee will as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Chris Gorsuch, District 49, East Multnomah County. I'm here to talk to you again about House Bill 2653. When we passed it out of committee, it was indicated that there was minimal fiscal impact. Since that time, we have found that for the Oregon State portion of the bill, because if you remember, Oregon State was going to be collaborating with the beekeepers and Department of Ag to create these best practices for beekeeping across the state, we found that they have come in with an exceptionally large fiscal at the level of $300,000. Now, I'm told that if the other B bills that we passed out of committee do get funded, then that $300,000 is no longer valid. It disappears because it's wrapped in with all the other bills. So the overall fiscal would be everything, my bill and the other four bills, but Ways and Means would have to sort that out. So what I'm asking for the committee to do is to vote to send the bill down to Ways and Means, and then if they fund the four, then this one won't have that fiscal impact. If they don't, then a standalone bill like this, they claim, would cost that $300,000. So that's essentially where we are right now.
Okay. And Representative Gorsuch, it is terribly unfortunate, and I sympathize with you, that the fiscal on this bill was late getting here, and through no fault of yours or this committee's, and sometimes stuff happens, and it did this instance.
Yes.
And we're going to try and make sure that we get this on track as speedily as is possible. Committee members, are there any questions or comments for our colleague? Yes, Representative Esquivel,
please. Very disappointed, Representative. I thought that we'd get to see you on the floor with a black and yellow shirt on, striped with a pair of antennas, presenting the bill.
I can do that. I have one, and it's it says Oregon across it.
There you go.
But, yeah.
All right, anything further?
Anything important?
thank you, Representative, very, very much. Committee members, with that, if there is no further discussion, if there are no further questions, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger, your last chance. Vice Chair Krieger.
Have you got my new script?
Oh, the new one.
Do we have an amendment into the bill?
No, use the ribbon part.
The what?
Yeah, read this and then do the hand.
Okay, Chairman, I move House Bill 2653 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2653 as amended to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the bill be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority vote, the motion passes, and the bill is on its way for a second time down a Ways and Means.
Thank you all. I appreciate that.
Representative, I want to make sure if you encounter any difficulties, please let us know, and we'll provide full support.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, Representative Frederick.
Representative Chair, I want to repeat my comments of earlier. Although I think we should add a font for every pun that is used regarding this B-bill. I just wanted to know.
Oh, thank you very much.
That really does sting.
King.
Where's the jar? We'll put a quarter.
Establish the fee.
Can hear the buzz in the hallways already. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the reconsideration and work session on House Bills 2653. Thank you very much.
Rep. Reardon isn't here yet. He's coming down for these three. You want to jump right down to 2053?
Okay. Fine. I'm going to open a work session now on House Bill 2053. Mr. Gallagher, if you can remind us what that bill was about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2053 directs the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to establish a Trophy Trout Lake Pilot Program. Funds the program with a dollar surcharge on angling licenses, requires the department to conduct study and surveys related to the program and report to the interim committees related to environment and natural resources no later than September 15th, 2017.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rollator, did you have anything that you wanted to remind the committee of? All right. Thank you, sir.
That's why I asked him. Chair Witt, members of the committee, we would like to have this bill moved to Ways and Means in its original form. I had originally discussed with Representative Krieger about cutting the bill down by 75%, but we think we'd like to have it, Representative Krieger would like to have it go to Ways and Means whole and have it be part of the discussion of the overall funding and programs for ODF&W in their budget deliberations. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Questions or comments?
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe, where is... refresh my memory. What are the certain licenses that's going to be the dollar surcharge on?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, it would be for all licenses. Sports angling licenses, the 1 days, the 3 days, the 7 days, the annuals, and the non-residents.
Interesting way to say that.
And Joe, there is a fiscal portion of this. Would you explain that too, so that the committee knows that we're sending this down a Ways and Means?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, it would be anticipated that the department would have to either grow or buy large size fish, and they would also have to do some surveys to determine whether those large size fish draw extra people to those lakes that are treated as trophy trout lakes. So everybody would pay the surcharge essentially that fishes, but everybody could also fish at those places. And for many years, the sports fishermen have contended that 3-to-the-pound fish, which are characteristically planted by ODFW, don't draw the public in, given all the competition with other kinds of recreation. Whenever we see Cabela's or somebody like that run a program where they have one large fish that has a tag, or they put a bunch of large fish in a small lake, there's an awful lot of enthusiasm around that, and so we'd like to reproduce that enthusiasm, see if it works, and then change, ultimately, if it does work, change the way that OEFW grows trout and the way they purchase trout for them to get more revenue. In California, the private trout farm that I work for, Desert Springs Trout Farm in Summer Lake, has been very successful in the Bishop area up above Yosemite to stock lakes that the stocking is paid for by the lodges and the local counties and jurisdictions. But their estimate is that it brings in an incredible amount of tourism because it gets people interested in coming all the way up to Bishop and fishing in those lakes because they have the opportunity to catch a 10-pound trout. And we don't have that opportunity in the wild very much anymore.
All right, fine. Thank you very much. So this is Vice Chair Krieger's bill, and Representative Krieger, of necessity, we're going to have to send this down to Ways and Means committee members. So with that, before I recognize a motion, do we have any questions? Yes, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me if you were going to evaluate a lake to see if it was drawing people in for that specific purpose, then you would want to charge the fee, the extra license fee, just for that lake rather than the license across the board for everyone who buys a fishing license. I mean, if this is in kind of an experimental stage right now.
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto. As we've discussed this project with various people, including ODFW, the idea is that we're trying to compare what ODFW does now with a new scheme of growing trout and planting them for people to catch. And so if we put a special price on the lake, which is done in some jurisdictions where they've done this sort of thing, then that's got a great effect on the amount of people that come to take part in that fishery. So we'd like to see it just straight up, no extra fee, then do the surveys before and after, and come back to this committee with recommendations.
Okay. Additional questions or comments? I'm seeing none. Mr. Rollator, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Appreciate that. And I recognize, too, I caught you off guard, so I apologize. With that, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair, would I move House Bill 2053 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means?
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2053 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that it be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on his motion? Any questions on his motion? I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
I probably shouldn't do this, but I just want to make a comment, which is that I think this sounds fishy. I did that for Representative Frederick.
You were right.
I should have done that. All right. Thank you. I apologize, committee.
Thank you, Representative.
I had to go
very much. And with that, is there any objection to the motion? Okay. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodside.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair
McClain. Aye. Chair Witt. Aye. Having received the necessary majority, motion passes, and the bill is on its way down to Ways and Means. Representative Esquivel.
That bill that we just had, thank you, Mr. Chair, on that bill that we just passed down to Ways and Means, can we have some kind of a feedback in a couple of years on what it actually costs for that program?
I think that would be a great idea.
Because we're talking $890,000.
Yes.
So I'd like to know where the costs are versus the revenue.
I think that's a great idea. Thank you, Representative. With that, let's see here. Hold on. Bear with me, folks. Where are we going here? Okay. Going to open. Oh, first of all, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2053 and open a work session on House Bill 3334. Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 334 requires Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to spend $2 million per year out of the flexible incentives, out of the flexible incentives account on implementation of strategies to protect and restore sage-grouse habitat. There are two amendments on the bill, and the first amendment on the bill actually changes from flexible incentives account to the correct account, which is the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. The second amendment changes the dollar figure from $2 million to $1 million over a five-year period. I'll read that amendment for you just to be completely accurate. For the period beginning July 1, 2015 and ending June 30, 2025, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board shall spend $1 million per year out of the funds credited to the Watershed Conservation Grant Fund established under the statute on implementation strategies intended to protect and restore sage-grouse habitat.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gallagher, I think that's sufficient. And are you aware of anyone that wanted to explain those amendments further? Anyone contact you?
I have not been contacted.
Okay, very good, sir. Committee members, yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering why it was changed from $2 million to $1 million, because it's such an important thing that we protect these so we don't get them listed in Eastern Oregon. Was it OWEB that asked for the change? Do we know? Or?
I don't have that information.
Okay, that's fine.
I do believe, Mr. Chair, that the representative may be down earlier if you wanted to.
That's okay. I don't want to hold up anything.
Okay. Very good. Okay to proceed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talked to Representative Benz this morning. He likes the bill as it is. It thinks it'll work better.
Okay. Good.
Without the amendments?
No.
My understanding as well.
Yeah.
He communicated with my office yesterday, and that was my understanding, too, so I didn't know if anything had changed overnight. Representative Esquivel?
Yeah, I'm kind of troubled about this approach that we're doing on the sage-grouse, because if we're losing 150,000 acres a year to the western juniper, and it takes $100 per acre to clear it, that's $15 million just to hold our nose above the waterline. So in order to start gaining on that, we must have at least $15 million plus
So I'm very concerned about our approach. Although I don't understand, and I've never been briefed on what the partnership is that the governor signed with Eastern Oregon ranchers or whatever it was with the federal government, because we haven't had the details on that, as far as I know.
Separate motion to approve like each one.
Yeah.
Approve the one and then the second.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. And Representative Esquivel, I think that this is could be considered a seed money, and there's no question that it doesn't reach the necessary amount. But this is would be OWEB's contribution. And I think for those who are interested in the issue, and I don't want to speak for Representative Bentz, but there are a number of people that have come together and said that they will seek others to be able to include their money as well in this project. So while it wouldn't technically be a match, it is the first seed money, and other interested parties are going to be requested to assist with these efforts as well. Anything further? Okay. With that, I'm going to, if there's no further questions or comments, I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair, would I move to adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 3334?
It is both. We're moving okay. With both the -1 and the -2.
Okay. Thank you. Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 3334. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. Vice Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 3334.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 3334. Any questions on this motion? Seeing none, hearing none, that motion is adopted as well. Vice Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3334 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 3334 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on this motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick. Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. The motion has received the majority votes. It passes and is sent as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
One thing, if we have an opportunity toward the latter part of this session where we could bring someone in that put all these pieces together so we could thoroughly understand what our approach is on sage-grouse, bringing in monies from here and there, so we can kind of get a better handle of what we're dealing with. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I think that's a great idea. Yeah. Chuck, can we note that for possible information piece?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, committee members. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3334. Representative, that was a great suggestion. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. Mr. Gallagher, what's up next here?
Well, we might want to wait for Representative Reardon on these three. He was expected earlier. Do you want to go right into him, or do you want to go right through him, or do you want to go into the public hearing?
What about 3360?
Yeah, so these are his three.
Okay.
There's one, two, three. They're all his. We can go right through them.
All right. With that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3360. Mr. Gallagher, can you remind us of this bill, please?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3360 appropriates funds from the General Fund to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to OSU for Bee Health Diagnostic Facility, for the Bee Health Diagnostic Facility at the Honeybee Lab.
Thank you very much. We didn't have anyone requesting explanation on this one, did we?
I did not get any requests for it. I might note that there is no revenue impact and that a fiscal light has been issued for subsequent referral to a joint committee on ways and means.
Okay, thank you very much. We get a fiscal light and they still send it to ways and means. There's no avoidance here, folks. Yeah,
we had a big one in judiciary yesterday and they didn't send it to ways and means.
Just can't win on this. All right, with that, committee members, any discussion on this bill? Again, this is one of Representative Reardon's trifecta. I'm not seeing any discussion. I'm going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3360 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 3360 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, motion, excuse me, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodsett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. A motion passes, and this one's on its way to Ways and Means as well. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3360, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3361. Again, Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3361 appropriates monies from the general fund to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for Oregon State University Extension Service activities related to pollinator health. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal has been issued. This will also be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
All right, thank you. And again, no clarifying requests that you're aware of?
We have not gotten a contact on a clarifying request.
Okay, very good. I'm not aware of any either. Looks like... we're good to go, I believe. Committee members, any questions about this one? I'm not seeing any. Vice Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3361 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 3361 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion on this motion, colleagues? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodsett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. The motion received the majority vote. It passes, and it also is this bill 3361 is on its way to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 3361 and open a work session on House Bill 3362. Mr. Gallagher, again, please, sir.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3362 establishes the Pollinator Health Outreach and Education Plan. There is a dash one amendment, no revenue impact. It does have a fiscal, and there will be a referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means. The dash one amendment accomplishes three things in terms of amending the bill. It directs Oregon State University to develop a pesticide use safety plan to educate the public regarding best practices in the use of pesticides. It provides that it is not necessary to provide the location of hives, but does continue to require contact information. And the third thing the amendment does is that it provides that the portion of the fees that went to honeybee and native research would be directed to research that is predominantly focused on honeybees.
Okay, thank you very much. Committee members, any discussion on the Dash 1 amendment? I'm not seeing any. Vice Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3362, dated 4/1/15.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3362, dated April 1st, 2015. Is there any discussion on his motion? Not seeing any. The motion is therefore adopted. Vice Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3362 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee of Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 3362 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, excuse me, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Moreno.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. The motion passes on a majority vote as amended and is sent to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3362. Committee members, good work. Thank you. And let's see, we got that one, that one, that one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. We got through our work session. Thank you all very much. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3382. Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3382 extends the sunset from January 2nd, 2019 to July 1, 2019. For law imposing general prohibition on growing canola in the Willamette Valley Protected District, requires the State Department of Agriculture to authorize limited commercial growing of canola on qualifying acreages in the district during part of the general prohibition period.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to call up Carol Mallory Smith, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Chair Witt and committee, I'm Carol Mallory Smith. I'm a professor at Oregon State University. I am the research leader for the research that came out of House Bill 2427, which was related to growing canola in the Willamette Valley in that protected district. And I wanted to give you a bit of an update on that research so that as it may play into House Bill 3382. There were three objectives, and I'm really only going to talk about the second objective, which was to monitor fields of canola, radish, and turnip and make comparisons between those crops as related mostly to either insects or diseases, also looking at volunteers, how they might impact further production. The fields were planted, the canola fields were planted in the fall of 2013. Radish was planted in the spring of 2014. The canola seed that was planted in the research fields was tested to be free of fomalingam, a fungus that causes blackleg, and I'll follow up on that in a minute about why that's important. And that canola seed that was planted was also treated with fungicides to prevent that disease from occurring. None of the fields planted in either 2013 or last fall in 2014 were genetically engineered, so they are conventional canola that's being grown. We also did monitoring of insects and diseases starting really at crop emergence and going through harvest. We didn't see any differences in insect pests among the canola, turnip, radish, or any of the other specialty seed crops that we were looking at. We didn't see any insect pest differences. However, you probably have heard about some of the disease issues that are facing the brassica seed industry in the Willamette Valley, and some of these came out of the monitoring that we were doing. So we identified blackleg, which is a disease of brassica species, in canola, turnip, forage rape, brassica vegetable seed crops, organic production, and on weed species. And this was across six counties in Oregon. We found it both in fall and spring planted crops. Of 63 of the sites that we monitored, we found that disease at 43 locations. There is no evidence, however, that the planting of the 500 acres of canola had anything to do with the outbreak of the disease. It was not identified in the fall when we first planted that as would have been a seed-borne disease. Blackleg has been present in the Willamette Valley for many years. Oregon Department of Agriculture has identified it previously in certification of fields. However, the incident of blackleg is greater than it has been in recent years. Additionally, we did identify other diseases that are present in multiple different brassica species, including, again, across the canola, turnip, forage brassicas, kale, weeds, and volunteer crop plants. So, again, this disease is widespread in the Willamette Valley. It was also found in spring-planted radish. So, as far as looking at the impact of canola, there isn't any reason to believe that having 500 acres of canola set within a very large brassica acreage in the Willamette Valley would have been the been responsible for the spread of that in 1 year. There's no way that any scientific evidence would support that occurring. It's an industry-wide problem that's occurring. It's an industry-wide problem. It's going to have to be addressed by every segment of that industry, not by any one segment of the industry. We've been working very diligently with as many sectors as we can within that industry to inform them about these diseases. We've been working with the Department of Agriculture in order to make recommendations on the best way to deal with this disease, these diseases in the Willamette Valley. One of the issues is volunteer control of the previous crop coming up in the following crop. Across the board, we've also not seen differences between radish, turnip, or canola. We've seen that there are volunteer issues with all of those crops. They can be controlled, and many of the growers are doing a very good job of controlling them, but there's not anything unique about canola in that system. The fall 2014, 500 acres of canola and turnip were also planted last fall. We've already been seeing blackleg disease and other diseases in, again, canola, turnip, and vegetable seed fields, as well as volunteer plants and on weed species. So again, we have widespread disease in the Willamette Valley. So that's an update really on the research that's been ongoing. As I said, my emphasis would be that we're not seeing anything unique again about canola in this system. We are also working on the other two objectives from that research, but as far as impact on, I think, the current bill that's being considered, that understanding that the disease is out there, but there's no indication that canola is responsible. So as far as comments on the current bill, then, I've testified previously that there's nothing unique about canola, canola's biology or genetics, that would require greater isolation distances than other Brassicaceae species. So as far as fitting within the production of brassicas, it would not need to be treated differently than other brassica crops. There's nothing unique about its biology or the species. So as is suggested in the current bill, as long as the 500 acres of commercial canola production were cited on the pinning maps, as other brassica species are, there should be no issues related to seed production, and there's no evidence that planting the 500 acres of canola per year will increase disease or other pest incidents any more than any other brassica seed vegetable crops would. Especially considering the 500 acres is a much lower percentage of the brassica crops that are being grown in the Willamette Valley. So with that, if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you very much. Dr. Mallory Smith, this is... This extends the sunset. The bill extends the sunset for about four 6 months. Can you tell the committee what that is intended to accomplish?
Well, I Chair Wood, I'm not sure. I think the only way I would read that is it's extending it long enough for that final harvest in that final year of when this is being suggested to have that grown. So it would have to go, you would have to extend it in order to have the last harvest.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Representative McEwen, please.
Chair Witt, just thank you. Just for clarification, I'm looking at line 14 on page 2. This extends it out to 2020. Is that correct? Am I reading this correctly? The section of this act is repealed January 2nd, 2020. I just want to be clear on what the end date actually is. Or am I reading this incorrectly?
It extends it to July 1st of 2019 is my understanding.
And then it up here.
Maybe the bill's different than the
December 31st. Oh, okay, got it. All right. My apologies. I was reading in the wrong place.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Thank you very much, Dr. Mallory Smith. We appreciate your appearance and your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to call up Jana Jarvis and Kathy Hadley, please. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jana Jarvis. I'm here today on behalf of the Willamette Valley Oilseed Producers Association. So the question today is, why is canola such a controversial crop, and why did we bring you House Bill 3382? And I think just to give you a little quick background, and I've got a handful of members here that want to talk to you about why growing canola is important to them, I thought you needed to have a basic understanding about it as a crop. It's a dry land crop, which many growers see as a viable rotation crop for wheat and other grasses. It provides some soil enriching options for no-till or low-till production and helps best break some of the pest and disease cycles for other crops. And it's a high-value commodity crop, and I think I have a member that will speak to that as well. As Dr. Mallory Smith mentioned, it's a member of the Brassicaceae species with very similar genetic characteristics to other crops that are allowed to grow unrestricted in the Willamette Valley. It doesn't present any unique cross-pollination challenges and has similar farming practices to other Brassicaceae crops. Canola is grown as a food source for humans and animals. And it's interesting, I think we brought around some of the seed for you all to see. It's a little tiny seed that looks kind of like a poppy seed, a blackish brown seed, but it's 44% oil. And so when it's crushed, it has a very high oil content, and then the meal is used for animal feed, and it's in very high demand, particularly for dairy cattle, because there's been some studies that show it produces better quality and higher volume milk when fed to dairy cattle. But what it isn't is, and we wanted to be very clear to this on this with you today, why people are opposed to this sometimes is because they think that the growers here in the valley are wanting to grow GE canola. And interestingly enough, I have members that will talk about the fact that they're growing conventional or hybrid varieties of canola because it produces better here in the valley. It's also not being grown for biofuel, although around the world canola is a source of biofuel. Here it is such a high value crop that it doesn't pencil out. It's being grown for food stock. So the 2013 legislation created a 6-year moratorium with a 3-year study. But so there'd be 3 years of no production. And what we're simply asking from you today is to allow that same 500 acres that hasn't impacted other crops that are grown here in the valley. You've already heard there's nothing unique about canola, And ODA has authority to regulate for pest and disease, but not for market conditions. So this bill would simply add up to those 500 acres and would allow us to work on a voluntary coexistence basis with other growers here in the valley. And with that, I'm going to turn that over to Kathy, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at a later time.
Thank you.
All right. Well, good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. As Jana said, my name's Kathy Hadley, and I farm both in Rickreall and Silverton with my family and my husband's family farms. We both are diverse crop operations and have some livestock too, grass seed, grains, legumes, hay, oil seeds, other brassica specialty seeds, and then the beef cattle. I'm here to support, encourage your support on House Bill 3382. I've been very involved with the canola discussion for over 10 years, dating back to when I did my master's in agriculture at Oregon State, and a lot of that topic centered around growing canola in Oregon. I've been on ODA advisory committees with this issue, participate in both sets of research trials, and I am a current board member on the Willamette Valley Oilseed Producers Association. Again, like I said, I encourage you to support this bill to allow us to continue growing the 500 acres of canola for the second half of the moratorium period. As Jana mentioned, the big important thing is to be able to continue to maintain those relationships that we've created and some of those markets that we've started to establish here locally. To go with a three-year absence would just bring everything to a grinding halt that we've got started. And that'd be very, very difficult and very frustrating to then, you know, hopefully someday get started again. It's much easier to maintain something, keep it on going. Canola has been a very valuable rotation for us. And I can provide, you know, additional details on any of this. Just please ask if you're interested. But it's a very good dryland crop. That's important for us because on both farms we don't have any irrigation. We don't need any additional equipment to harvest this crop. In fact, the settings on my combine to combine our annual ryegrass are almost identical to canola. So very simple and ready to take straight to the processor out of the combine. It doesn't need cleaning or processing. It really helps us control the grass weeds, having a broadleaf rotation. Spraying a grass weed out of a grass field is a lot more difficult than spraying a grass weed out of a broadleaf field. And we produce a lot of blue tag and registered seed stock grass seed on our farm. Focused on maintaining purity of the different varieties, and so having a rotation crop to help keep fields clean is very important. Bottom line, canola has been very profitable for us. In the years that we've raised it on both farms, we've netted more than we have on our wheat, on our spring grains and legumes, on some of our other brassicas, including turnips, and even several of our grass seed fields, depending on the years and the specific contracts. In fact, last year on our Silverton farm, which is a lot more limited, being at 1,000 feet and not having much topsoil to work with, we ended up netting, when we sat down and ran the numbers, two times the amount that we did on our fine fescue over there. And that was with record high prices for fine fescue last year and a very average yield. So even in less than ideal conditions, canola performed very well, and we don't have a lot of rotation options over there. So it's very promising for us up there. There's very good yields here in the valley. Easily can expect 4,000 pounds of the acre. We have a local processor. There's high demand, just both domestic and worldwide. So I fully expect this market to continue like it is with the strong prices. Having the local processor is huge to be able to just deliver right there after harvest. And we also had money in 30 days, which I'm still waiting for my money out of my forage brassica that I raised, contracted a proprietary variety last summer. So that's obviously quite an important factor for managing cash flow. One big thing that Jana mentioned is the demand for the non-GMO oil, seed, and meal is very significant. And we do prefer, at this point, the hybrid and conventional varieties because they do yield better. And if we don't need those GMO traits, why use them? So we've been very happy with those, and I think that helps make it a good fit for the valley. Very quickly, I want to address a few of the negative misconceptions. One, talking about isolation. On our farm, we raise 16 different kinds of fescue. I'm very aware of what you need to do to maintain isolations and to follow rules to maintain those standards for marketing purposes. We've dealt with the pinning system for the last 10 years, raising brassica crops that have been contracted. There is no reason that canola needs to be unique and could not be managed through the existing pinning system or another similar public system. Also, talking about blackleg, yes, blackleg is here. It's been here. That's well documented by the ODA's inspections through the years, for decades. As Dr. Mallory Smith mentioned, all the seed we planted was certified seed that was both tested free of blackleg and treated. Fields have been treated as well with fungicides. You know, big picture, every crop we grow here in the valley has disease issues. Every single crop. And I'm not trying to downplay the significance of blackleg. It's not to be taken lightly. But at the same time, if we were to ignore or mismanage the septoria or the stripe rust in our wheat, we would have the same devastating crop failure or economic impact that we could have from blackleg and brassicas. So, you know, for me, the disease, well, like I said, not to be taken lightly, is a management issue that we watch and control, just like with every other crop. You've heard from many ag groups this session talking about voluntary coexistence between crops. For me, canola is just another one of those crops that can be grown and managed with communication and cooperation between neighbors. I encourage you to support House Bill 3382 to allow us to maintain our limited acreage of production, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you both very much. Questions from the committee members? Representative Barreto, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is limited to 500 acres in the Willamette Valley, and most of the argument you just gave basically said those 500 acres, they're not an issue, whether it's GMO, whether it's cooperation from neighbors. So why is it limited to 500 acres? I mean, if the value that you were explaining, you know, is so great, and I would think a lot of farmers would be wanting to use this. So.
Can I answer that, Mr.
Please.
Chair, Representative Barreto? I think when we looked at this, what came out of the 2013 legislative session, it was a 6-year moratorium with a 3-year study, and so we talked about simply coming to you and lifting that moratorium after year 3, after the results of this study, but thought perhaps we would take a more modest approach, and we've opened up that market, those 500 acres, there's a demand for that. There's concerns that canola will take over the valley. I think that's not what these growers are interested in promoting, but we wanted to take a more modest approach with this particular piece of legislation. At the end of the 6-year moratorium, conceivably there would be no limits on growing canola, so it's just a modest step.
So it's just a test cycle, right?
Yes.
And if I could add, Chair Witt and Representative Barreto, I do think it's important to acknowledge and respect the work that the last legislature, or 2 years ago, session did in funding this study and the work that Dr. Mallory Smith and her team has been working on, and to jump in, you know, more full force and suggest lifting the moratorium at this point, I think would undercut that study and the efforts they've done so far. So that's also partly why we wanted to, like Jana said, take a more modest approach.
So just to drill down on that, the purpose for the 6-year extension would be?
Well, Mr. Chair, we weren't involved in that discussion, so I'm not sure I can answer that question.
Okay, we'll ask some of the other witnesses then. Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean, please.
Well, first of all, you should give lessons on how to give testimony. You're very organized, so thank you very much. And you should also be the business manager of your farm if you're not. Very knowledgeable on your crops. In this time, you talked about the idea of cooperation between, you know, the farms as far as buffers and so forth. And have you found out anything in the last, you know, 2 years or 3 years that would change how you buffer this particular crop?
So, Chair Witt and Vice Chair McLean, we have not found anything out. To echo what Dr. Mallory Smith said, we've not found anything out that's made us view canola in any unique light. We raise other specialty brassica crops, as I've mentioned, that have been pinned. Other neighbors do as well. And we haven't had any issues either with controlling volunteers, any extra disease, anything like that that we normally anticipated.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Yes. I was wondering, on your hybrids, are they F1 hybrids, or are they further, and do you do the hybridization, or are you buying seeds that are
hybrid.
So, Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt, my understanding is that they are F1 hybrids. We've been purchasing them through Rubisco Seeds, which that's exclusively what they deal with is canola seeds and very specifically hybrid varieties. And again, everything certified, treated, tested, documented. Great. Well.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Additional questions or comments? Thank you both very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate the brevity in the testimony. And if everyone could speak specifically and directly to your points so that we can plow through this as quickly as possible, I would greatly appreciate it. With that, I'm going to call up, please, Nick Tishinen, Greg Loberg, and Gary Vockler. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
Good morning.
Please decide among yourselves the order of your testimony.
I'll lead off.
Very good.
I'm Greg Loberg, and I am an officer of the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, and I work at West Coast Beet Seed Company. If you hear me say WVSSA, that's short for not having to completely spell out Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association. The group has a long history of seeking genetic purity among numerous specialty seed crops in the Willamette Valley. This includes all members of the Crucifer group, such as radish, and the many species found in the Brassica genus, which we've just heard about, including cabbage and its relatives, as well as canola. Canola is somewhat unique because of its oilseed properties. For industrial and, in more recent times, biofuel use, as well as, of course, you've just heard, edible purposes and feed purposes. In other words, it has non-seed applications, unlike what WVSSA deals with, seed crops. The potential for industrial canola to contaminate or actually poison edible canola was a primary reason for the Oregon Department of Agriculture to establish control areas beginning in 1990. The ODA, or Oregon Department of Ag, adopted rules that also included protection of seed crops of related species based largely on pest and disease considerations. Numerous reviews and adjustments to the rules were made until an impasse developed between the WVSSA and the Department of Ag early in 2013, and as we know, legislation ensued. At that time, ODA loosened restrictive rules related to the Willamette Valley, which had been largely a control district that excluded canola. The exclusion existed in various forms for over 20 years and supported a large expansion of world-renowned crucifer seed production. The purpose of the 2013 legislation was to set up guidelines and to fund research to address the short and long-term effects of canola grown, not for seed, but for oilseed, with its much higher tolerance for genetic impurity.
Owned by their first name.
Beyond numerous agronomic questions around the research, the Oregon Department of Ag in 2010 had summarized some other considerations, four of them as follows. The considerations included the appropriate use of the ODA's control district authority as it relates to pests and diseases, the unique character of the Willamette Valley for specialty seed production. Thirdly, the number of fresh vegetable operations was a consideration, including smaller farm operations whose markets include local buyers, all of which could be negatively impacted by canola pests and diseases. Fourth and last, the ODA considered the opportunity to grow canola in many other areas of the state. These considerations remain and actually have not changed. The argument of the WVSSA today is that House Bill 2427 set in motion a plan for comprehensive research and reporting of that research. 2427 was based on a six-year plan, and the outcome of the research is not yet known. WVSSA would argue that we should not add controversy to what has been controversial off and on for years. So the WVSSA opposes 3382. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
Well, Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Nick Tishinen. I'm the president of Universal Seed Company in Independence, Oregon. It's a international seed production company. We've been in existence in the Willamette Valley for nearly 30 years. We produce very high quality, very high value seed that basically funds the world industry for Brassica Seed. I'm also the owner and operator of Sunnyview Red Barn LLC, which is a diversified farming operation here in Salem. We grow standard crops, wheat, grass seed, vegetable seeds, and I'm also the current member and past president of the WVSSA. I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bill 3382 for the following reasons, and I will be brief and to the point. Legislation was enacted in 2013 to address various issues of conflict between the production of oilseed canola and other commercial brassica and brassica seed in the Willamette Valley. Funds were provided to OSU to undertake a study with certain allowances and restrictions for the production of commercial canola during this time period. There's been no change in the conditions that prompted the legislation. Changing the existing law presupposes to know the outcome of the study. The current legislation and study should be allowed to be completed as designed. The only major change from 2 years ago, when House Bill 2427 was passed, is that the valley is now in the throes of a major blackleg outbreak that threatens the continued viability of all brassica crop production, including canola. I feel that this is not a prudent time to reverse the conditions of the existing law. The WVSSA member companies sell high-value seed to every corner of the U.S. and the world, generating significant export income and supporting hundreds of family-wage jobs for Oregon. Companies make investment and hiring decisions based on their understanding of the business environment, including existing laws. My company, Universal Seed, is nearing the end of a two-year, multi-million-dollar capital expansion designed to keep up with dramatically increased market demand that we've enjoyed and to maintain state-of-the-art processing facilities. And I would welcome the members of the board to come out anytime and see what goes on in Oregon agriculture. We carefully considered our recent expansion and hiring based in measure on the presumed six-year time period to study and sort out this issue. Changing the existing law will have a chilling effect on all the brassica seed industry in the valley, including my business and its employees. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chairman Witt and committee members. My name is Gary Vochter. I reside at 17124 French Prairie Road, St. Paul, Oregon. My wife and I own GH Farms. I'm a third-generation farmer, and I've farmed for about 33 years. I've grown several crops over my farming career. It includes grass seed, grains, clovers, and specialty seeds for about the last 10 years. We have irrigation systems we've expanded in the 90s. We put those in, and it's helped us be able to be to grow a lot of different crops. The vegetable seeds have given us a great rotation crop. I'm not opposed to ODA allowing the testing of experimental crops to expand the options for growers. I am opposed to allowing new crops brought in that put established crops at risk. Canola is a crop that will do that. Canola will contaminate other crops by cross-pollination, field-to-field movement of contaminated equipment, and non-control of volunteer seeds in the ground. In my experience, the higher the oil content in a seed, the more that oil just naturally it protects the seed. I mean, think of if you're oiling your leather shoes or something. It's the same thing. When I've planted some vegetable seed crops, and some are worse than others for volunteers. It's a nice natural rotation to plant grass behind it. Grass is a perennial crop, so you're working the ground down, you're leaving it there for 3 to 10 years or more. Next time you flip that ground up, you're gonna flip up seeds that have not germinated. Possibly will break dormancy. They will break dormancy. Some will, because you never have 100% of all your volunteer seeds that you throw out the combine or you lose during the harvest process. They don't all sprout. My fields would always be look pristine, perfect if that ever happened, but it doesn't. So we always are fighting volunteers, and the higher oil content is only going to make it worse. I've been told many times by the buyers of clovers and vegetable seeds that they will walk away from Oregon-grown seeds if the canola growing areas are expanded to the point of risking contamination. Buyers have walked away from other countries that have allowed canola production. And once they're gone, it's hard to get them back. The only way to keep them from going away is not to allow any more expansion of the existing zones. We all have to follow rules, laws and rules, and as vegetable seed growers, we follow a pinning board rule. And it restricts from what I can grow or what I can't grow, because there's, between vegetable seed crops, most of them, there's miles of isolation. And it's to protect the integrity of the crop that Nick is trying to sell. It just gives our customers reassurance that they're getting the quality they request, and hopefully for us, it returns us higher dollar value for our crop. Seed companies and growers have spent a lot of time investing in infrastructure, building relationships, and in some cases, decades of time. All this could be lost for good if canola is allowed to contaminate these crops. For these reasons, I'm opposed to HB 3382. Let the established rules play out, and let OSU do their testing and give us the research, do their research, and let's get the results before we make any more longer-term commitments. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you. Vice Chair McLean.
Well, this is to whoever wants to speak, but my understanding is this is not enlarging. It's just keeping the same 500 while the YOSU continues to do their study. Is that your understanding of this legislation?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Yes, Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this is not expanding it, and it is just keeping the 500, what is the objection that you have? And this is not repealing the law in 2013. So explain the objection, because if there's no expansion. The concerns that you've brought up are very important. The seed industry in the Willamette Valley is incredibly important. And as you said, one set of contamination can create, if not destroy, but certainly have a severe impact on the seed industry. So what is the objection here to this particular extension?
Chair Witt and Representative Frederick, it is an expansion, not of the 500 that was set in place for a three-year period. It's actually a doubling of the total amount of canola allowed in the six-year period. It's a 500-acre allowance in years 4, 5, and 6 versus only a three-year 500 per acre maximum per year. So it's adding 1,500 new acres over a three-year period. And part of the research, we didn't want to get into too many details, but I'll say this because of the background. Part of the research includes a post-harvest monitoring for each crop grown during the three-year period. And that second three-year period, years 4, 5, and 6, allows for monitoring to occur then and, frankly, thereafter. There was a five-year period encompassed where OSU had the option, as it deems practical, to go out and monitor for volunteers, pests, and diseases. Continuing to grow canola in years 4, 5, and 6, essentially, although OSU can monitor it, it's not being funded. So I doubt that it gets monitored, but I can't speak for OSU. But I'd be surprised if the crop grown in years 4, 5, and 6 is monitored like the crop grown in years 1, 2, and 3 in the existing legislation.
Just to follow up, please. You heard the testimony from OSU on how they felt this was going. You're saying that you are not convinced by that, or what? I'm trying to get a sense of where you are on the testimony.
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, the research that's done will include not just replication in season, but replication over time. So we're concerned that reporting on a single year out of a three-year study with a three-year follow-up is not a complete research report We're simply asking for the research, which was carefully crafted 2 years ago and codified in legislation. We are asking to continue a well-planned project that was set in motion by the legislature at that time.
One last
please. Please.
I want to suggest that I'm glad that you brought up the additional 1,500 acres, basically, because that's an important factor. That was not the way it was presented in many cases. So thank you for bringing that up. I also want to thank you for talking about how important seed industry is for the Willamette Valley and why this bill was passed in 2013. It was not an attempt to be overwrought about something. It was, in fact, a concern about two industries or several industries, and this is important for us to see. So thank you for bringing it.
Additional questions? Representative Whitsitt.
This might be better addressed to the OSU professor, but since you grow these seeds, do you have any feeling for F1 hybrids? Are they more likely to cross-pollinate in your brassica seeds? So we heard testimony that the F1 hybrid is what they're using for canola, and those traits are not as strongly set in the canola then when you have an F1 hybrid versus later. So from the looks of you...
The short answer is no.
Okay, so...
No, whether it's an F1 hybrid or whether it's an OP or whether it's a GMO organism, an organism, the genetically modified organism, the propensity or the probability of outcrossing is fairly equal.
Okay, great.
Outcrossing is a matter of time and distance and... gene count. And so outcrossing is only one of our concerns. I'll leave it at that. If you have any further questions, I don't want to take up your time.
I just want to follow up then, if I may.
Yes, please. And the for the record, the last response was from a Nick Tishner.
Yeah.
So if you grow 1,500 acres more, like you're talking, does that mean that you have an increase in the probability or possibility of cross-pollination?
The answer to that is it depends upon how those 1,500 acres are controlled, Representative Whitson. It's an issue of seed bank that we are more concerned about.
All right, seeing nothing further, Representative Esquivel.
Maybe I missed something here, Mr. Chair, but we're talking 500 acres, correct?
Per year, yes.
Okay, so now you're lumping this together and saying 1,500 acres because it's 3 years and 500 acres.
Correct.
Interesting mathematics.
Well, it's 1,500 acres of seed bank.
I understand that, but it's still only 500 acres.
Per year.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Additional, anything further? Gentlemen, yes, please.
Chair Witt, if I can make one further comment, and not about that. We are all for voluntary coexistence at the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association. It's what we do. We have 35 or 40 members. We put crops on the map for the purposes of isolation. What is different about asking us to continue without changing House Bill 2427 is that there has been a control area that involved canola that was put in motion by the Oregon Department of Ag. And that is unlike other crops that we voluntarily coexist with inside of the WVSSA. So it's come as a bit of surprise after 20-some years of having a regulated canola to have something that is less regulated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. All right. Having a difficulty reading names here, so I'll do the best I can. I'm going to call up now Scott S., T. Endicott, and Anna Scharf, please. morning to each of you, and welcome to our committee.
Good morning.
Chair Witt and committee. My name is Scott Setnicker. I graduated from Oregon State in 2005 with a crop science degree. Took many classes from Carroll. Currently, I farm on our family farm based in Independence, just across the river, with my dad. And we grow about 15 different crops, mostly irrigated, but we also have some dry land production. We grow paper, peppermint, spearmint, hazelnuts, processed vegetables, corn for grain, which is mostly all GMO production. We grow wheat, we grow canola, we grow several types of grass seed, as well as several different types of specialty vegetable seeds. So this issue is kind of a hard one for me because I kind of grow both crops. My history with canola, I grew canola in 2008 on some dry land production when it was allowed in the first research project. Was really happy with the results, so we wanted to continue growing some subsequent years, but we're not allowed because the ban was in place. When the bill 2 years ago came up and was allowed 500 acres, I wanted to continue to grow some, so I grew. I had roughly 90 acres last year in the research program, and to be honest, I was blown away with the results. Carol Mallory Smith was out at the field when we were combining, and she said, "How's the yield doing?" And I said, "Well, I think my yield monitor's broken because it's reading 6,000 pounds. That can't be real." Well, we started totaling the trucks up at the end of the field, and my yield monitor was right. My average was almost 5,000 pounds per acre. I grossed over $1,000 per acre on that field, which compared to the annual ryegrass I had on the other side of the field, which is a seed crop, I only got $450, and I still haven't got the money on that because I haven't sold it yet. That's what I should get. So, you know, as a grower growing canola, it's kind of like swimming upstream because we have all the seed industry trying to bat us down. They don't want us to grow it. But for me, it's like, you know, it's a good crop. It's been profitable. So, I mean, that's why we're all here. All of us that have grown canola are still here 10 years later. Almost now. So, like I said, it's a very, very complex issue. My older brother actually works for the Universal Seed. I work with Nick on a daily basis. He's a great guy. He has valid arguments as well. But I feel like as a valley and as a farming community, we need to figure out a way to make this work. You know, because we're all friends. We're all seed growers. Every one of us in this room, we all grow seed. Every grower in the Willamette Valley grows grass seed. A lot of growers grow brassica seed. So to sit here and say, since I'm a canola grower, you know, I don't understand seed growing. I may grow canola, but next year I'm going to grow a seed crop there. So this canola is making my seed more valuable because it's going to help me keep my field cleaner. So like I said, I think the key is we all need to work together. And this bill is important because for us, those of us that are growing canola, you know, we're investing in some small pieces of equipment to grow this. And the bill just allows me to continue to grow the little bit that I'm growing every year moving forward. And it is pretty much just moving the status quo forward for the last 3 years. And the one thing that about the study, you know, they're studying turnip, radish, and canola. Well, at years 4, 5, and 6 of the study, radish production is going to be allowed to continue. They're not stopping radish production for 3 years to see, you know, what the effects of the study are. Turnip production is going to be able to continue for those years. But why does canola need to be stopped for 3 years? And, you know, how does that play into my markets for my crops? So I think that needs to be addressed. And I think that's why all of us here that want to grow canola are here sitting for you. So I guess, like I said, I think the most important thing is, you know, as farmers, we need to work together. We do it on several other crops. I grow a processed vegetable and field corn. Both of those cross-pollinate. So when I grow, you know, a field corn field next to a neighbor, I have to talk to them and say, look, this is what I'm growing. You're growing sweet corn. We got to time our planting so that my crop gets planted early enough, you know, there's enough time to pass between it so they don't can cross-pollinate and ruin each other's crops. So voluntary coexistence works, and it has worked, you know, moving forward. And quite frankly, it's worked for the last year, two years when we've placed our canola fields. The specialty seed industry has been more than helpful, you know, working around us and allowing us to grow our fields because we've been able to pick fields, us canola growers, that haven't conflicted. So, I mean, voluntary coexistence is working currently. So I think I guess that's what I got to say.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chairman Witt and members of the committee. My name is Anna Scharf, and I'm here today on behalf of Scharf Farms, and I'm also a board member of the Willamette Valley Oilseed Producers Association, and I'm here today to urge you to vote yes on the bill before you. I'm going to take time. I'm not going to bother reaffirming the comments that have been made and the comments that Mr. Endicott will make, but I'd like to share with you what I see as the economic value of canola to family farmers, since we're all family-owned farms. For crop year 2014, Scharf Farms grew 118 acres of canola under the ODA, Oregon State Research Program. We also grew 143 acres of radish that was contracted privately to a seed company. Both were rotational crops to grass and wheat. Canola is a commodity crop traded on the open market, just like wheat and soybeans. We, the grower, determine when we want to sell and how much we want to make on that crop. We play the market, if you will. So we determine when that cash flow is going to happen for our business. At the time we harvested the canola, the markets were very favorable. We delivered it immediately, and we were paid within 30 days. The radish, different story. Like the canola, we delivered the radish immediately after harvest, the proprietary crop on a payment term. The first crop payments are due to us in April 15th, next week, but there is diminished hope that we are going to receive such payments, and we're not alone in this concern. As of today, Scharf Farms, along with 31 other family farms, have filed crop liens with the Secretary of State's office totaling $4.5 million for radish seed grown under contract with a single company. Cash flow in farming is extremely important, and it's even most important during harvest when we have high labor cost, high fuel output, etc. The ability to harvest a crop, sell it immediately, and have that cash flow is something that you have to have. Other rotational crops that we grow are proprietary, radish, grass, clover, row crops, etc., and have longer payment terms. They're not like canola or wheat, which we can control the cash flow on. Therefore, from purely an economic standpoint, House Bill 3382 allows some family farmers to have that cash flow opportunity, and the additional years would allow us to continue to do that. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Thomas Endicott. I'm the Vice President for Business Development at Willamette Biomass Processors, which I will just call WBP here in the future, 1055 South Pacific Highway West in Rickreall. We're Oregon's only commercial oilseed crush facility. We've been in operation since 2008. We invested about $2.5 million in a mothballed wheat storage facility out in Rickreall, 432,000 bushel of storage on rail out there. We created 10 new full-time jobs with benefits. We process soybeans, canola, camelina, and flax. Our facility is organically certified through Oregon Tilth, and we also process conventional crops, but as a result of being organically certified, we only process non-GMO conventional oilseed crops. We're here to encourage you to support House Bill 3382 to allow the 500 acres of canola production to continue through harvest 2019. As you heard, we purchased all the canola seed that was produced in the Willamette Valley last year. We processed that seed into canola meal and canola oil. We sold the canola meal to dairy and chicken operations here in Oregon. We sold the canola oil for livestock feed. If we did further processing, we could go to food grade, but at this point we sell it to livestock feed. None of it went to biofuel. And we cannot import canola from outside the Pacific Northwest region. It's just not economic for our facility to do so. So we buy from the valley and a little bit from Central Oregon, Central Washington. As you heard from Carol Mallory Smith, we believe the study will find that canola is identical to turnip and radish. I think she stated as much. And both those crops, turnip and radish, are unrestricted in the Willamette Valley. And now that we've established 500 acres of canola, and I don't think anyone's giving you a number, among 15 to 20,000 acres of turnip and radish last year, we need to maintain that acreage until the study is final. I also just want to mention that I won't go into detail, but ODA has rules for how to grow brassicas. They've had rules on canola since 2005, and just last year they brought the standards for all the other brassica crops, radish, turnip, and specialty seeds, up to the standard that canola had since 2005. So as you heard, 500 acres is a small amount within 15 or 20,000 acres. We certainly haven't impacted the markets. It's identical to turnip and radish. We use the same pinning system. This is kind of a no-brainer. If we could rely on a reasonable volume of canola we would receive each year, we would invest in food-grade refining, and that's our hope for the future. But we'd have to invest another $1 to $2 million in our facility, and we're certainly not going to do that and create those jobs until we're confident that we can have that volume. Canola fills a niche in the Willamette Valley, just as turnips and radish fill a niche. This bill would keep the 500 acres of canola whole until the OSU study is complete, at which time a more equitable, and I stress science-based, approach to brassica production in the Willamette Valley could be developed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For this panel, I was, before you leave, I was listening to your testimony, and Scott, I know that you said that you grow various crops that could cross-pollinate. And Anna, you mentioned that you grow canola and you also grow radish. Do you grow turnip too?
We have not grown that.
Okay. And Thomas, you said that you talked about, I think, canola, radish, and turnip. For those of us who are not farmers, is there a common thread there between those three crops that there's a point to be made?
So, Chairman Witt, I'm also not the farmer that's sitting up here.
Okay.
And I will correct myself. We do have turnip in this year.
Okay.
Because we could not grow canola this year.
Okay.
The demand amongst the growers was so high that we stepped back and allowed someone else to grow that this year. But for us, we would treat all three of those as a dry land rotational crop,
mm-hmm.
To further benefit the crops coming afterwards, such as my canola field last year is now a grass seed field, and the best grass seed field we've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I guess the distinction I would make is canola, turnip, and radish would be the crops you would grow on dry land. A lot of the crops that the vegetable seed, specialty seed crops that some of the other people testifying are talking about are more grown on irrigated ground, such as kale and cabbage. And those aren't going to be really grown on the same ground as canola. It's just that ground's irrigated. It's some higher value. So the canola, turnip, and radish is going to be grown on basically dryland wheat / dryland grass seed ground. So that's kind of why we've made that distinction. And in general, the radish, turnip, and canola, you know, radish and turnip are like a broad acre, and they're a slightly lower value seed crop than the vegetable seeds.
Okay. Now, all three of those are brassicas, are they not?
They are in the brassica family.
Okay.
Turnip and canola are in the brassica genus, so they would more readily cross.
Mm-hmm.
Radish is in the raffinous genus.
Okay.
So just to clarify, if I could, for one second.
Please.
The production, as Anna and Scott said, very similar, larger acreage, you know, 100 acres in a field, for example. But one distinction I really want to be clear about is the Specialty Seed Association representatives here made a point about seed purity. Well, canola is a larger acreage. Specialty seeds are grown on smaller acreage, maybe 5, 10, 15 acres. Radish and turnip are grown on these larger acreages. The production method is the same as for canola. The seed goes to plant in cover crops or something different other than being crushed, but the quality of the seed is the same. And yet turnip and radish are pinned and allowed to be planted through the Specialty Seed Association, and canola only does that through the good graces of Oregon State and ODA, placing these fields for this three-year study.
Which is precisely where I wanted to go with my questioning. So you talked about voluntary coexistence. We've heard a couple of panels talk about that now. As brassicas, the potential exists for the canola and the turnip to cross-pollinate? Yes? No?
with the other brassica specialty seed species.
Yes.
Yes.
And so it's not only an issue that you, for your neighbors, you are yourselves growing two crops or possibly three that could cross-pollinate on your own property, and you found a way to make sure that that does not happen, yes or no?
Well, I believe it's through the same isolation that the Specialty Seed Association uses. I mean, when you isolate at the distances that are required, there is no threat of cross-pollination. And that, I must remind you, too, that the study has nothing to do with cross-pollination. The study from 2013 is pest disease and weed pressure. Mm-hmm. I think we've all agreed that if you isolate according to the rules that we're not allowed to play by, canola's not allowed to play by, that you solve that problem.
And so...
And to add, Chairman Witt, the other thing, especially with the contracted radish seed, it's tested by Oregon State University for purity, weed, so on, properties that you would similarly test wheat and grass and other grain crops. It's being tested for those. So if there is an issue with that, the grower's going to take the hit, not the contracting company that's proprietarily owning the seed. We don't want that to happen.
That is an important point. Thank you. So you have not only developed a method for planting that avoids cross-pollination on your own property, but presumably by extension, that same mechanism would protect your neighbors as well if you get together with them. Yes.
Well, I think the idea is that all the crops participate through the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association isolation rules, which is the case, and that protects everybody.
Yeah. So currently, the way the last year and this year, the 500 acres that were placed, the College of or Oregon State University, working with the Department of Ag, went to the Specialty Seed Association and placed our fields in, you know, into their mapping system. And I know that in some of the turnip fields, I think there was some issues with isolations, and the companies for those turnip, they agreed to it and they signed off on it. So currently, the 500 acres is within the framework of their pinning system.
Very good. Thank you.
To quickly add to that, Chairman Witt, there is the opportunity for the seed companies to do what is called an isolation variance. So the two companies can get together and decide to grow closer together.
Very good.
Not the grower.
Anything further? Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
So if you plant canola, can you later plant turnips then in the same field? Or after you've planted canola, would you be not able to grow other brassica seed in the same field? So, for example, if I'm just trying to understand, that's question one, and well, go ahead and answer that first.
So technically, you need to have like a 4 to 5 year rotation between any brassica crop. So if I were to grow canola and wanted to come back with a different brassica, I think the ODA actually has rules in place currently that it requires, I think, a 4 or 5 year rotation. So to prevent buildup of disease, that's just standard practice amongst the growers. And, you know, if you were to follow with radish, you know, there could be some purity issues if the seed was in the soil. But that's where, you know, management on your farm, on the individual farmer comes in. There's different tillage techniques, all different factors that go into play in, you know, controlling those, the you know, when you follow back with your herbicides and stuff.
Please.
So if a farm is sold, are you obligated to pass those records on to a future owner that what had been grown there? I mean, I'm just curious.
Well, I mean, there's nothing that I don't think legally that requires you to. I know we have one farm we leased for several years that got bought by another farmer, and I handed over my records, but I mean, it's up to individual farmer.
Chairman Witt and Representative Whitsitt, I don't believe there's ORS is requiring you to do that, or OARs. However, it would be foolish not to, because especially if you're growing certified grass seed, for example,
right,
when you file with Oregon State University, you put what the last 4 year crop rotations were in that field for certified grass seed,
great,
not a brassica crop.
Representative Witt, and just to clarify, I'm sorry, Anna, I think there actually is an OAR that ODA put into place late last year for all brassicas, and I believe the rule, don't quote me, I think it's you can grow 2 years and five, and you cannot grow back-to-back, and that's for all brassicas, canola, turnip, radish, specialty seeds for all brassicas. It's just good management. And there are additional rules for brassica production in those OARs that I won't go into, but it's just good management practices that they've instilled in those.
Thank you. Representative McEwen.
Oh, Chair Witt, just to follow up on Representative Witsit. So what I'm hearing you say is if a farm was sold, they could go back to to Oregon State and find those records. They would have filed with Oregon State. Is that correct?
Well, if they had grown certified seed in the past on the field.
There would be records they could tap into if the farmer didn't pass them along.
Potentially.
Yeah, okay. And would those be filed with the pinning system, too? They could go back and look?
No, that's a whole different system. That would be like the Oregon State seed certification system. And that's mostly used for grass seed.
And Chairman Witt and Representative McHugh, the pinning system is not owned by Oregon State University. That's right. Managed by WVSSA. So it would be up to them to release those records.
Follow up.
Please.
If a farmer chose to participate in that system, though, then they could access records that were prior for the fields that they may want to grow a certified seed in.
Which system?
I'm just trying to follow up with with Representative Witsit.
Which system?
The pinning system. If they wanted to be a part of that organization and they purchased ground that had prior been part of that organization, then they would have access to those prior records.
So Chairman Witt and Representative McEwen, that would be a great question to ask the WVSSA, but it's my understanding that individual growers who are not members are not allowed to have access to that data. It's companies that have access to that data. So if I bought your farm,
contracting company,
and I wanted to see what you grew and it was pinned through them, I'm not sure if I would be able to have access. That's a question that would be great to ask them.
Follow up.
Yes.
But if you contracted with a company that had access, that's where that. Okay, got it. Thank you so much.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this testing for this canola has to do with volunteer plants, diseases, and insects. Has nothing to do with cross-pollination or anything like that. So we heard about blackleg earlier, but I think from the lady from OSU, but said that really is prevalent with all of these. And so growing, extending this growing period for another 3 years, will that have a tendency to increase these diseases, let them spread, or is this something that is controlled and shouldn't be concerned about? I mean, we're trying to base this on information as far as where we go on this bill, and just trying to get down to what the bill actually is for, which is an additional 3 years, but it looks like it's just for these volunteer plants, diseases, and insects. So,
I mean, that's probably a better question to be answered by Carol. But as far as on field-to-field management goes, you know, as a canola farmer and as a seed grower, I know I've treated my canola basically the same as my seed crops. I've sprayed multiple times with fungicides. And I don't think anybody really knows where we're going to be next year. I think looking at the blackleg earlier in the growing season this year, everybody thought it was going to be much more severe at this point in the growing season. But as the year has progressed, it's much harder to find the disease now than it was. Maybe that's the fungicide treatments that have gone on. But I guess I probably can't answer that question.
Representative Witt and Representative Barreto. Just to add to what Carol Mallory Smith had mentioned earlier, I'm losing my train of thought here. Sorry. Your question again?
Actually, I was just asking about the testing that's going on right now.
Right.
It's just for volunteer plants, diseases, and insects.
Right.
I mean, I understand I think there's also a fear of cross-pollination added to that, but as far as the study itself,
you had asked about blackleg.
Yes.
And Dr. Mallory Smith had mentioned that all of the canola seed that was planted was tested free of blackleg disease and treated with fungicide seed treatment to prevent that disease. That was not true on all the other brassica crops necessarily prior to this year. So ODA, that was a standard that was set in place in 2005 for canola, but ODA did not bring that standard of testing and treating seed for all brassica crops, including the 20,000 acres of turnip and radish that were planted last year 500 acres of canola within that 20,000 acres of turnip and radish, in addition to the specialty seed, which is probably treated very, very well because it's such a high-value crop. So is it increasing the disease potential? Not in comparison to the large, large acreage of turnip and radish that were out there this past year.
Folks, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony and your patience with our numerous questions. With that, I'm going to call up, please, Ivan Molesky. And Tim Wynn, please. Gentlemen, if you can make your points very briefly, I would be most appreciative. We've got one more bill we got to get on after you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. We've submitted written testimony, which I hope you'll take the time to look at, and I'll just paraphrase a few key points from that. First of all, we're submitting this testimony in opposition to House Bill 3382 today. We believe this bill will undo carefully crafted legislation from 2013 designed to protect the Willamette Valley's world-class specialty seed industry, as well as the Valley's clover seed, cover crop seed, fresh market vegetable, and organic industries from the introduction of commodity canola. In 2013, as you know, the legislature passed House Bill 2427, which extended a longstanding moratorium on commercial production of canola in the Willamette Valley until 2019, while funding 3 years of needed research on the impacts of canola on similar crops. Rather than waiting for the results of this research before determining how much or even whether canola is compatible with other established high-value crops, this bill jumps the gun before the halfway point of the research has been reached by authorizing ODA to approve additional commercial canola production and not envisioned in the 2013 bill. To illustrate this conflict, this bill authorizes commercial canola production to begin after July 1st, 2016, while 2013's bill directed OSU to provide the final results of its research by November 1st, 2017. House Bill 3382 not only supersedes the existing research process, it goes further, and it explicitly authorizes unlimited planting of canola in 2019, contrary to the spirit and the intent of not only House Bill 2427, but previous legislative actions that enacted a more cautious and responsible approach. Unfortunately, because the research taking place now is not even at its halfway mark, no new information has been presented to demonstrate that opening the valley to commercial canola production is any less risky or any less problematic than it was 2 years ago. In hearings on this issue in 2013, this committee heard from international seed companies located as far away as Japan and Europe that they would likely have to stop purchasing seed from Oregon growers and seed companies due to the risk of cross-contamination of seed crops. We're talking about 100 industries valued at over $100 million that are at stake with this issue. And we need to, and House, that's why House Bill 2427 focused on building a strong baseline of data before further management decisions about the future of canola in the Willamette Valley were made. And I'll just say that this bill not only presumes that commercial canola production is appropriate, it also assumes that either the WVSSA will agree to map, maintain, and enforce isolation distances for canola fields during the three-year commercial production cycle this bill authorizes, or alternately, that ODA or OSU will do this pinning, maintenance, and enforcement without any additional funding authorized. This is not a responsible approach. So there's a number of key questions that remain. We've listed a number of them on the second page of our testimony that should be addressed before commercial canola production is expanded. I don't think we have clarity on what the appropriate isolation distances are to ensure cross-pollination does not occur. We also don't really understand fully the likelihood of the genetically engineered herbicide-resistant canola to cross-pollinate with feral, brassica, mustard weeds and spread these herbicide-resistant traits into the wild. What would be the economic impact of GE herbicide resistance spreading to common mustard weeds in the Willamette Valley? What is the actual, one of the things that we're looking at now in the study that we don't know the answer to is what is the potential for off-field movement of canola seeds after harvest? What is the likelihood of seeds traveling off-site during heavy rains or flooding events or moving into ditches and waterways where they can germinate far from original field locations? What about seed shatter from trucks on the roadsides? We already have, what's the baseline information on wild mustards that are in the ditches already along roadsides, and how might canola seed shatter exacerbate this issue? What is the true economic risk to the industries we're putting at risk through this bill? The Willamette Valley is unique in the world for its capacity for vegetables and seed crop production. If anything, the legislature should make the Willamette Valley Protected District permanent. preserving its role as one of the world's most important seed-producing regions, and further, should explicitly ban production of genetically engineered herbicide-resistant canola, which poses even greater risk than conventional canola does. Nothing in these bills does that, and for those reasons, and the others we listed, we oppose House Bill 3382.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Chairman Witt and the committee, thank you for letting me testify. My name is Tim Nguyen. I am president of the Specialty Seed Growers of Western Oregon, the SSGWO. We represent somewhere between 100 and 200 specialty seed growers in Willamette Valley. I don't have a fixed number right now because our membership does fluctuate from season to season. We're in the process right now of pinning down our existing membership for assessments for this following this upcoming season because we're mostly a research based crop development and crop problem solvers as far as funding research with Oregon State. That's our main goal, although we are in our charter allowed to deal with legislative issues. So our board has elected to oppose this House bill, and rather than testify further with more facts, we would like to reiterate those points made earlier by Greg Loberg, the WVSSA. The only thing that I'd like to add at this point is that those of us on the board have extreme concerns about forage radish and turnip for exactly the same reasons that there's been expressed concern for canola. So it shouldn't be taken lightly that it's being used as an argument to support more canola production because we are growing brassicas at a larger volume here in the valley now with forage radish and turnip. However, without knowing what that's going to involve, those of us in the industry are concerned about the possible ramifications that are going to come from that. So not that we're trying to stretch anything we're doing now, but we do believe that the current research that's being done is going to give us some good information, educate ourselves to what we're up against, allowing for some research that needs to be done, and possibly opening some other questions in the future about some of these other production practices. As a farmer, I have witnessed quite an increase in wild brassicas, or I should say volunteer brassicas, because most of them are not of wild genetics, showing up on the gravel bars along my operation, in which I have to go out and take physical means to eradicate because they can cause problems with cross-pollination and possible disease transfer to my crops. So these things are things that we need to keep in mind. You've heard a lot of excellent testimony from both sides. You've got a lot to consider, and I thank you for the chance to testify.
Thank you very much. Committee members, I have one more witness and one more bill. With that in mind, are there any questions? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you very, very much. I appreciate your testimony. Call up, please, Representative Clem.
It came from Seneca, so I'll just let it go.
Okay.
On the bill, you need to.
Very good. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3382. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3435. Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3435 authorizes the State Department of Agriculture to require persons holding or applying for licenses to engage in seed transactions for commercial purposes to report grass seed supply information. It authorizes inspection of records to verify information and allows license sanctions for failure to report required information.
Thank you very much. Call up, please, Mark Simmons.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask Matt Crocker to join me?
That'd be fine. And do you think you can do your testimony in 3 minutes?
I can certainly try. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill.
What this bill does is provide permissive authorization for the Department of Ag to collect data from seed dealers. Our organization is a cooperative of farmers, 160 members, and our primary role is to negotiate seed prices. We do that with two meetings. Our first is what we call the data meeting, where we make our best guess as an industry, dealers and growers combined, at how much seed is going to be available and what our market, what the consumption is going to be, and what the carryover is going to be into the next year. After that, we meet and negotiate seed prices. And the prices that we set become a benchmark for the whole industry and actually affect seed prices for the varieties that we negotiate prices on. And they affect seed prices worldwide. Now, in the past, a dealer contracts with a grower to produce seed for him, proprietary varieties, and that dealer then is the only person the grower can sell his seed back to. Now, in the past, there was no firm deadline by which the grower had to be paid. A grower, in some cases, I knew growers who sat on seed for 4 years in a downturn waiting to be paid. Growers didn't have to be paid, there was no need to exercise any kind of market discipline. Just grow a lot of seed. When we can sell it, we'll sell it. Now, several years ago, the industry approached the legislature and asked for some sideboards to be put around the industry and around contracting. And one of the things that came out of that was a firm deadline that growers must be paid by May 1 of the year following harvest, which is 9 months after harvest approximately. Pretty generous, but it allows the industry to work. With that came a big incentive to begin to manage production because the seed has to be paid for. We're blessed here in Oregon to produce about 60% of the worldwide supply of cool season grasses. And with that, we can influence the price. We can't influence the price of wheat, corn, soybeans, or other commodities, but grass seed we can. The world markets do react to production and pricing set here in Oregon. Now, the USDA collects data. They collect data through a big survey every year that covers all kinds of things, wheat, corn, soybeans, cattle, but it doesn't cover anything to do with grass seed. It's of no help to us. Participation is required by law, and all the growers receive it. We do get some information from seed commission reports, but that is rearview mirror information. It is information that passed from seed that passed from the grower to the dealer in the past. We would like forward-looking information. So we put together an Acres for Harvest survey in collaboration with the seed commissions. We've worked together to fund this, and it gives us the first forward-looking information the industry has ever had. It's a voluntary survey with 80% support from growers. We then approached the ODA and asked for that they would do a rulemaking to require dealers to report their inventories and the acres that they've contracted with growers. And we had some support from seed dealers at the time. The ODA came back. They questioned the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General said, no, you don't have authority to do this. We've been on a real tear in the seed industry. Good markets. Everybody's pleased. But with that, we've reached an equilibrium now, not too much, not too little, and some dealers have become a little bit nervous. If we get a downturn, they don't have the operating line necessary to pay for excess seed on May 1. And so their only alternative then becomes dump seed at below the price we negotiated. And so the urgency of better information is brought to the forefront, and we decided to go ahead and try to move this legislation this year. It would provide an option to allow the ODA to collect information. The ODA is not in the business of arbitrating disputes. They don't like to be. That's part of the reason you see the canola issue here. And they would, they've told me that they would, if this passes, they would tell us to get together as an industry and come in holding hands and let them know what we want to do. The industry has struggled with data. There are conflicting opinions about what kind of data should be gathered, how we should use data. And we believe that this is important, so we brought this forward. We need and want dealers to be profitable. And we put a lot of time, energy, and money into producing our crops, and we believe that time, energy, and money deserves the best data, the best planning, the best thing we can do to manage our industry. We know that data is not a silver bullet, but it will allow us to react more quickly to changes. If we get a major economic pullback, such as we had in 08 and 09, we would know ahead of time. We would know how much seed we've got on hand, where at that time, without watching what was going on in the industry, we had a year's extra supply of tall fescue, and growers really took it on the chin. We believe that meaningful progress is incremental. This is an incremental step. It's a small step that would allow us to continue this debate before the Department of Ag, and we would very much appreciate your support.
Thank you very much. Mr. Crocker, we've pretty much run out of time. Can you do this in 1 minute, or would you prefer to come back?
1 minute.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Witt, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing me today. My name is Matt Crocker. I'm a fourth-generation grass seed grower in Monroe, Oregon, and I'm also president of the Oregon Grass Seed Bargaining Association. Our function is to set prices for turf-type tall fescue and turf-type perennial ryegrass. And we need to get that price set right, and we get one chance to do it a year. With such a monumental task and with such consequences of getting the price set wrong, we need to have the best data available. And that's our goal here, is to get the price set right. And there's no redos on it, and we need to have the best data available. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you very much. And, sir, you were right on the money. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And, folks, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3435. We will be reopening it at a later date to hear the remaining witnesses.
Continue it.
So I'm going to continue the hearing on House Bill 3435, and I'm going to carry over the hearing on House Bill 3459, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate that.
Sure.
Brett?